Hello, this is your host, Chris Connor. The episode you're about to listen to is sponsored content from MediLumine. I feel this is a valuable discussion on the role of animal research in life sciences and the three R's of reduce, refine, and replace. Please give it a listen and share your feedback. Now let's jump into it. Are we ready?
Yeah, we're ready to go.
Okay. Stephen Marchand is the CEO and founder of MediLumine, providing high-quality instruments, reagents, and accessories to support preclinical imaging programs in the life sciences. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you, Chris. I'm delighted to be here.
All right, so today we're going to talk about small animal imaging. So first of all, let's talk about why we do research on animals at all. What are the advantages of investigating diseases in vivo animal models?
Thank you for the question, Chris. It's a really it's a great question, and I think one of the things recently that really sort of blew me away was the podcast from Dr. Cindy Buckmaster called Get Real, where she was able to interview and get first person reports from animal care technicians that went through the pandemic. And one of the things we didn't really hear about during the pandemic was basically everything that these people actually went through and experienced, and that research centers were closing. So they were responsible for euthanizing, you know, thousands of animals, and just the type of stress that they went through and hearing how they were affected by that. It really shows you that they have this kind of dual role where, as scientists, they're responsible for taking care of the animals, and yet they have to go through these really difficult experiences of being responsible for these euthanasias. So that was just incredibly moving to hear these first person reports from these animal care technicians. And then the second or third episode, I think it was the third episode, where Dr. Buckmaster has a family that's there. And you know, going through all of the experiences that they had with aplastic anemia, and that was just incredibly moving. And you see that one of the therapies that was used there was horse antibodies. So when it comes to these diseases, when it comes to incurable diseases, I mean, we have a responsibility. We are, I think, compassionate beings. We want to, it sort of goes beyond, I would argue, even goes beyond almost what you could reason. It's something that's very much part of our nature. One example I like to give is early onset Alzheimer's disease. I mean, so imagine a scenario where you have a mother coming back home and announcing to her children, that within the next 10 to 15 years, you're going to see me completely lose my mind. So, well, when we come into situations like this, I mean, what are we going to do? I mean, so what we've found in the medical sciences is animal research. And if you look at the therapies today, the medicines today in the clinic, there's a plethora of medicines that were made possible by animal research. So, when you actually, listen to podcasts like Dr. Buckmaster's podcast, and you hear the reports, what you discover is that the people taking care of the scientists taking care of these animals, and the animal care technicians, they're taking care of these animals, and it's very important for them. The research that's being done, the therapies, they're intrinsically motivated to work on these therapies, and some of the times they're even within, you know, pediatric research contexts where they're on their way to the lab, they're encountering, you know, children that have cancer and things like this. So I thank you for your question. It's not something that is incredibly socially accepted. That's an extra weight on the shoulders of the scientists that are doing this work. And it's something that indirectly, like I'm also exposed to, right? So like you go to a cocktail party and somebody asks you, what do you do? Well, I'm involved with laboratory animal sciences. And I think, I'm very proud of that.
Yeah, it's no one takes this lightly. on either side in terms of taking care of animals, or, you know, in the case of a child with cancer or a mom with early onset Alzheimer's, are we going to just say no to those people? No. So,
Exactly. And what's incredible is that as we work really hard on developing the technologies to do this research, we were able to develop technologies like in vivo imaging that is allowing us to reduce the amount of animals used in research, reduce the amount of terminal studies, being able to offer complementary data where imaging the animal is actually allowing us to answer questions related to the effectiveness of, you know, therapeutic interventions that we're testing. So that whole development of the in vivo imaging, preclinical imaging modalities and contrast agents, I think has been a huge breakthrough for the animal sciences as well.
Yeah. So let's talk about those modalities in preclinical in vivo imaging specifically. How are each of them different, and how are they used differently to get different information?
So the way that I like to think about it is to say that, you know, every modality has a strength and a weakness to it. So if you think about, for example, MRI or computed tomography, well, one of the strengths of those modalities is just the resolution. So you can get a really nice, nicely defined, high resolution image. So for example, if you're looking at, let's say, an orthopedic researcher looking at an implant that has, let's say, a size of, 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter, you can actually reconstruct it in 3D and quantify the volume of that structure. So the resolution of those modalities are really impressive. When we think about sensitivity, we would want to go towards other modalities like optical imaging or nuclear medicine like PET CT or SPECT CT. So those are those modalities have the advantage of being very sensitive, but not as high resolution as the microcomputed tomography, which is why you also see some of these multimodal imaging systems that are offering both, for example, the PET and the CT. And that's something we see in the clinic, but we also see preclinically in the lab.
Right. So it sounds like the trade-off is I can either see where something is to a high degree of resolution, but maybe it's not as sensitive, so it has to be larger or in some way, or I can see something with a lot of sensitivity, but then the location or the resolution goes away.
Yeah, exactly. One example I like to give is if we were for example, if you were to place, let's say, a cube somewhere in a mouse, and you know you were going to image it, and you didn't tell the imagers where that cube was. Well, if you were, for example, let's say you had put some contrast agent in the cube, maybe some mix of iodine and some bioluminescent substrates, and you wanted to be able to really, localize with precision exactly where the tube was, well, you'd be able to get that answer with microcomputed tomography. But when you're reducing the concentration of the contrast agent in the cube, well, it becomes a little bit more difficult to get a really nice picture of the dimensions of the cube. For example, they could be, let's say, I don't know, half a millimeter by half a millimeter. If you're decreasing the concentration of iodine, that's going to be more difficult to really get a clear volumetric picture of that cube. However, with optical imaging, it's a very sensitive modality. So you might be able to see something at lower concentrations. For example, with bioluminescent imaging, if you look at some of the tumor studies, in some of the publications, we see even a few days after the injection of tumor cells, we're able to see signals, but we're not necessarily able to localize them very well. So for example, if you have, let's say, a signal in the right lobe of the liver, you would see something coming with optical imaging, but you wouldn't necessarily be able to localize it and say precisely exactly where it is. So you can sort of, with that example, you know, you can sort of get an idea of the strengths and the weaknesses of the different imaging modalities.
And just to be clear, when you're talking about bioluminescent imaging, we're talking about being able to see light through it within the animal. It's coming out and being able to be detected, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a huge breakthrough for research in general, whereas researchers have been able to incorporate the luciferase gene into cells and even into organisms. And so in the presence of the substrate, which is the luciferin substrate, these cells are actually going to glow and emit light. So there's a huge amount of research that's being done with that, and it's a very robust method for assessing the effectiveness of a certain therapeutic intervention by being able to record and measure the amount of light coming from the imaging system, so from the organisms.
All right, so let's talk about the difference of imaging in a small animal like a mouse as opposed to imaging in a human. I didn't really appreciate this till you and I had a conversation recently about why imaging in mice is still different from humans for very practical reasons.
Yeah, that's a great question. So if you take, for example, let's say, you know, you're going into the clinic and you need to get a CT scan. And they're going to be, let's say, injecting some iodine to, you know, have a look at maybe your kidneys or your liver. What ends up happening is those scanners have been developed so that the scans are very fast. And the contrast agents that are eliminated by the kidneys, they're also eliminated very rapidly. So you need to have a scan that is maybe lasting about 60 seconds and, you know, even faster. So if you use those contrast agents that were developed for the clinic and you try to use them in laboratory research, you're not going to see a lot in the mouse because, you know, in order to get some, you know, some nice high resolution data, you're looking at scan times that are about, you know, a minimum of say 2 minutes. And by that time, the contrast agent has been completely eliminated from the mouse. So what ends up happening is that in order to design the contrast agents for, you know, laboratory animal sciences, you need to be able to have a contrast agent, which is going to circulate in the organism for longer periods of time. And when I started my company in 2013, we were very lucky to have been able to acquire a patent, the commercial license for a patent from the University of Michigan, where scientists Jamie Weikert and Raymond Council and Doug Bacon had looked at this question very deeply. And so they had this really amazing idea of to be able to increase the stealth properties of the contrast agent, so the amount of time that is circulating in the animal. They were able to design a contrast agent which was resembling the structure of chylomicron remnants. So these are little fat particles that are being circulated in the body. And by developing these oil and water emulsions with these lipid nanoparticles resembling the structure of chylomicron remnants, they're able to sort of integrate into the metabolism of the animal. And the consequence of that is they're able to get much, longer residence times in the animal before the contrast agents are eliminated. So it allows for very high resolution imaging of the tissues, and it really unlocks the power of the whole microcomputed tomography modality. So after the injection of the contrast agent circulating in the blood, for the first phase, you can get very high resolution vascular images. And then as these polyethylene glycol chains are falling off of the nanoparticles, the nanoparticles are then targeting the hepatocytes in the liver, and then that allows you to get very high resolution images of the liver. And even more recently, we were able to identify other soft tissue structures like the prostate. So there's just a huge variety of things you can do with these types of contrast agents. And it's just been really fascinating to look at the whole evolution of the contrast agents. Our most recent formulation of the Finestra HDVC contrast agents are actually based in a modified version of vitamin E. So we know that, the chylomicron remnants are able to target the hepatocytes. And so now we have these nanoparticles that are based on the research of Dr. Thierry Vandamme, his laboratory in France. And they're now based in a vitamin E formulation, which is targeting the hepatocytes.
So for a more general audience, because I'm sure the people who do animal imaging already appreciate this, but I think this was really interesting. You know, as scientists, we look at animal models and, you know, mammals all laid out similarly, four limbs, you know, a head, a spine, so on. But we don't really appreciate the difference that the size makes. So that's doing right. These imaging things to detect, you know, a liver, which is smaller than a fingernail in an animal, is very different than detecting my liver, which is probably the size of my head inside my abdomen. So just the challenge of imaging small things. Talk about that.
Yeah, so the imaging physics is going to be completely different between, you know, the clinic and, you know, what's happening in the lab. So you're needing to obtain information at, you know, resolutions which are in the micron scale, it's not going to be the same type of considerations that are going to necessarily go into the design of your instruments. And that's why there's a whole industry around developing these instruments and developing these contrast agents. So you know, when we consider, my expertise is more on the contrast agent side of things, but, you know, when we consider, for example, a liver cancer, well, one of the really amazing things about liver cancer in the lab is that we're able to image it in very high resolutions in the liver. So we're able to see tumors that have sizes of under, you know, 500 microns. So they're appearing as these negative contrast zones in the tumor. So there's, at the same time as there's kind of there's a little bit of a disconnect in terms of, it's not necessarily what's happening in the development of these preclinical hardwares is not necessarily the same science going into the clinic. At the same time, that the kinds of questions we're able to answer in the lab is just really impressive. Imagine if in the human side of things, we were able to do early detection of cancer and catch tumors that had sizes of under, you know, a millimeter. I mean, it would be really impressive. So there are some considerations when you're trying to translate into the clinic. And there are some aspects of the preclinical research which are definitely translational when it comes into the clinic. And so that's one of the things. I've been involved now with small animal imaging since, 15 years. And that's one of the really impressive things that I've seen over the years, is just the evolution of all the biomedical engineering departments trying to develop clinics, technologies preclinically that are translational and have the potential of getting into the clinic.
And that's exciting. All right, let's shift gears a little bit here. The three R's of research are reduce, refine, and replace. How does your work at Metalumine fit that model?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, if we look at, well, we looked at the reduce component. So, you know, it's definitely something that's helping to reduce the amount of animals that are used in research, but it's also allowing us to refine the research methods. You know, there's certain answers, certain questions that we're able to answer with preclinical imaging that we were not necessarily able to see with these terminal studies, histologically. So, for example, one of the nice breakthroughs we had with the contrast agents in micro-CT is that when we're looking at things like fatty liver disease, we're seeing that at the whole organism level, the capacity for the animal to actually metabolize the contrast agent in the liver is completely altered. So by looking at the kinetics of how that happens, we can assess the severity of the fatty liver disease. So it's allowing us also to refine the research methods. So it's just been a really an incredible thing to experience this whole evolution in the last 15 years. And I'm really just really proud to be able to work with in the laboratory animal sciences and with researchers that, you know, my experience of working in this field has really been that the researchers and the scientists taking care of these animals, they really care about the animals. It's very important for them to be able to optimize these research methods. And so to be able to contribute to that has been just incredibly rewarding.
Nice. Yeah. All right, let's talk about the idea that bringing new products to market in life sciences can be difficult, largely because changing people's behavior or methods can be a bigger obstacle than the science itself, where there should be a definite solution. But you know, getting people to change how they do things is a challenge sometimes. What's been your experience as an entrepreneur in this area?
Yeah, that's a really great question, actually. Let's say a PhD student enters into the lab and they have a question of you know, how to do a certain method, where they're going to go into the lab manual and they're going to go find the method that's there. A lot of the times, the method that's going to be there is there because it's what's being published. So when you try to enter into this world with a new technology, it's very challenging to get that new method or new application adopted. So the barrier to entering this market is very high. A good example would be, so we recently developed a contrast agent for looking at post-mortem micro CT imaging. So we're things like looking even at human organs in cadavers. And so this is a silicone infusion product, which is creating a vascular cast and is allowing you to visualize all of the microvasculature in the organs. Now, it turns out that the product that the scientists have been using for the last 50 years actually has lead in it. And surprisingly, we're starting to get a much more adoption. We just have a new publication that's come out today from Dallas. We're very excited about it. It's been a very long process to be able to get this type of adoption. If a scientist needs to make sure, of course, that all of their research is going to be reproducible. So they're going to want to go with, you know, what's being published and, you know, what has been reproduced in the scientific literature. And there's a whole network to these publications. So it's very challenging to start to get this adoption, to, you know, get the momentum where people are starting to use it, but they're also able to work with other colleagues and other labs and say, well, you know, I have generated the same results with it. And so these are considerations when developing a product, and, you know, for the laboratory sciences.
Right. Not only does it have to be reproducible itself, you have to prove at some point it's equivalent or better to what was being done before. That's the first hump, and then be able to use it on a consistent basis.
Yeah, exactly. And our whole philosophy on that was, I had the chance of working with a scientist actually from California by the name of Dr. Bill Dow, and he said something to me really incredible at one point. He said, you know, Stephen, let's use the world as its own research laboratory. So when we would come in with a product, one of the first things we would do is we would try to find these beta sites and these early adopters and say, okay, well, here's an idea. I'll send you a free sample if you test it and I'm able to get access to some images that you generate. It's free of charge. So early on, we were able to generate some interesting data this way that we're able to use for some marketing and then, you know, be able to get our first orders of products and then being able to get our first publications. So it's a long process. You need to know where you're going If you know where you're going, you're going to get there. And if you don't know where you're going, you're also going to get there. So it's going to requires quite a lot of patience.
That is a fact. I like that. That's a great way to wrap up. I also like the idea of using the world as your own laboratory. And of course, you know, getting people to test out things for you lowers the risk for them, gives you information, helps get the product to market.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Stephen Marchant, this has been a treat to talk to you today. Learned a lot about small animal imaging, which is fascinating in the fact that it's just not the same as a smaller version of a human.
Yeah, exactly. It's been a delight talking with you about this, Chris, and I really appreciate you, everything that you're doing with this podcast. I'm a big fan, and thanks for being there.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.